You're now listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.
Hello, Colorado. This is Jarvis Caldwell with Engage the Rockies. I am the executive director of Engage the Rockies. Thank you for joining us today. Today, we are talking school finance, and I am joined by none other than Mr. Glenn Gustafson. And I couldn't think of somebody better to have on this podcast than Glenn, just from my personal experience working with Glenn in the school finance arena. Glenn is a CPA. He's been with the Colorado Department of Education since 2022 as a school finance manager. His duties include training and assisting school districts and charter schools all across the state of Colorado. Previous to CDE, Glenn was with the Colorado Springs School District 11 for over 32 years. His position was Deputy Superintendent, Chief Financial Officer. He received his BSBA in accounting from the University of Colorado in 1982 and his MBA with an emphasis in finance from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs in 1990. Glenn is a certified public accountant and certified public finance officer. Glenn, thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Jarvis. My pleasure.
So we have a lot to cover today. School finance is a very, from my perspective, complicated topic. And so we have a lot of questions for you today. And hopefully for our listeners, by the time we get done with this, they'll feel like experts themselves. So our first question for you, Glenn, is how are Colorado schools, public schools, financed? Just big picture, how are they financed?
Great question. So it's a great framework to frame the whole conversation of the podcast. School districts in Colorado are financed through a mechanism called the School Finance Act, which is adopted by the legislature each year. The School Finance Act sets a number of different factors in the equation. So every district starts at the exact same base. There's 178 school districts in Colorado. We all start at the exact same base amount of funding. Then when each district gets a different amount of funding based on their unique variables related to their community. In general, the biggest factor that is most influential on funding is the size factor. The smaller the district, the more funding they get. That's because of economies of scale. And we always have to remember with school districts, it's all about staffing. Most districts spend 80% of their budget on salaries and benefits. And so when I go to a rural district in Colorado, they may have four kids in a first grade classroom, whereas in my old school district, District 11, we could easily staff classrooms with 25 or 27 kids with no problem. So the size factor is the most significant, but there's other factors. The cost of living in that community, districts that are in higher cost of living areas like Aspen or ski areas, they get more money because they have to pay staff more to live in their community. And there's other factors related to English language learners at risk and a number of other different variables that ultimately determine the amount of per pupil funding for each school district. Then just one more piece of that puzzle. Mm-hmm. So the way districts receive their funding is first they're required to maximize their local property taxes and specific ownership taxes in accordance with the Taxpayer Bill of Rights constitutional amendment. So they have to levy the amount of property taxes that they can under Tabor. Whatever they don't get from local share, we call that local share, they get from the state. And we do that, we CDE does that so that there's equity among districts in terms of we wouldn't want an Aspen to have $50,000 per pupil because they have high assessed valuations of property. And then an Aguilar school district in Southern Colorado get $5,000 because they have very low assessed valuations. So whatever they don't get from local share, they get from the state in order to basically equalize. That's why we call it equalization, equalize that funding for each school district.
That's great to know. Mill levies. So mill levy was a term when I first heard it. I was like, I don't know what that is. Let me Google it really quickly. And so the question for you is, how does a local mill levy override work for school districts?
Yeah, so let's talk about property taxes, because we all know that, because we pay that property tax on our home or dwelling unit. So that local share of property taxes is in the School Finance Act. But in addition to that, districts are allowed to go for a mill levy override on top of that local share. Now, the voters have to approve it. It has to be on the election. The school districts can only have an election in November of each year. And a majority of the voters have to approve that election question in order to provide that additional funding for the school districts. We typically see districts in more affluent areas have higher mill levy overrides. There is a maximum amount of mill levy override, and right now that maximum amount is 20% of a district's total program funding. And total program funding is a very simple calculation of per pupil revenue times the number of pupils. And so the state does that because they don't want the wealthier districts to have unlimited resources, and the higher poverty, lower socioeconomic communities, they struggle to pass those because a mill levy override can be a financial strain on their taxpayers in their communities. So they don't pass at the same rate as a more affluent district, and also not at the same amount of funding as a local district. So we have several districts in Colorado that are maxed out on their mill levy override at the 20%. They are typically the ski area towns, but we also have some unusual places that you would be surprised at. Manitou Springs is a maxed out mill levy override community. And now what we're seeing a lot of is the oil and gas communities in Northeast Colorado are maxed out for mill levy overrides. That's easy for the voters to approve because really the oil and gas industry pays the majority of property taxes in their community. And so the impact on a local homeowner is relatively minimal. But that's how the mill levy overrides are work in Colorado. They generally are for operating costs. So you typically see districts use those for teacher salaries, maybe class size, reduced class size, things like that. But some districts use them for capital, and that's allowed. We strongly recommend that there's a citizen oversight committee to be a watchdog over those funds because they are supplemental funds. In my old District 11, we not only had a mill levy override oversight committee, but we had a detailed spending plan, and we had a triennial audit by an independent party that looked at how we spent the money just to ensure the maximum accountability. That's not required, but we strongly recommend that.
Excellent. So since we're talking about levies, can you explain the difference between bond levies and mill levies?
Yeah, it's interesting. Mill levies have really taken off. Mill levy overrides have really taken off in the last 15 to 20 years. But prior to that, we all knew bond levies because that's what built our neighborhood school. And the theory behind that was a district would go to the community. They would ask for this property tax increase. They would use that property tax increase to finance a new building over 25 or 30 years. And that kind of matched the equity. You wouldn't want all the taxpayers in the community in that year to pay for a school building, which has gotten very expensive. Now it's not uncommon to see high schools cost over $100 million. So we would spread that cost out over 30 years with a bond, 25 or 30 years. That's how a bond levy, but bonds can only be used for capital. The great thing about bonds is when the district issued bonds, they're double tax exempt if you live in Colorado. And so if you're an investor and you buy those bonds, you know that it's double tax exempt. You know that it's probably a very safe and secure investment for your portfolio. And for the district, they get the advantage of a lower interest rate. So it's mostly for capital, and the IRS strongly regulates bonds because of the double tax exemption component of that. As opposed to the mill levy overrides, which are mostly for operating costs, although we've seen a new trend in school districts across the state where they will sometimes issue a mill levy override and then issue certificates of participation. We call those COPs or COPs, but that's a lease purchase transaction. The advantage of COPs is you can do them quickly and efficiently for a specific target, The disadvantage of that is the voters don't get to approve that. It's just up to the District Board of Education. So we've seen a lot more districts using mill levy overrides for COPs. That's a kind of a new phenomenon. Traditionally, they've been more for operating costs.
Excellent. Well, thank you for clarifying that. We're going to move on to kind of more current year budget type deals for the audience here. So how many dollars are attached to each student in Colorado currently for the total budget for the year?
Great question. And, so
yeah. And if you can elaborate, has that number grown, shrunk over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah. Great question. So for fiscal year 23-24, the current year that we're in, the average per pupil revenue for every student in Colorado is $13,600. But I want to be careful with that, the word average, because it's not a weighted average. Because the size factor is so influential, we have smaller rural districts that literally get $24,000 per pupil. Whereas the vast majority of students in Colorado, because they're large districts, get much less. I would say a weighted average, or even if you looked at a median, would be a lot closer to $11,000 per pupil for 23-24. Big districts like Denver, Aurora, Boulder, Colorado Springs, those districts really bring down the average if you were to do a weighted calculation, as opposed to just an average across all 178 school districts. So to put that in comparison, so if this year the average is 13.6, if you go back to fiscal year 13-14, approximately 10 years ago, the average was $8,400 per pupil. So it's grown not by 100%, but probably 75% in the last 10 years in terms of funding. We've seen a great increase in school funding, but it took a while for that to happen. For a while there, we were just ticking along with very low inflation prior to COVID. And remember, the base funding amount, which every district starts at, has to go up by the inflation increase. That's under our Constitutional Amendment 23. So we were ticking along at less than 2% every year. And then all of a sudden COVID hit. Now we're seeing high inflation. And so we're seeing a pretty significant increase in per pupil revenue. And of course, that's corresponding with a pretty significant increase in the cost of operating a school district.
Excellent. So sticking with kind of current events in school financing, the Colorado legislature just announced they were or are passing a bill. Depends when you're listening to this episode here, how far it is in the process. But to pay down, pay off, remove the BS factor, can you explain the BS factor, why it's needed, and whether this legislation is positive or negative for school finance?
Sure, be glad to. So the BS factor, which is the budget stabilization factor, in case listeners are maybe thinking it stands for something else, that came about in fiscal year 09-10. So for years, we were funding school districts. The current School Finance Act was originally founded in 1994. So it's 30 years old. And school finance acts generally are like dog years. 30 years is a long time for a school finance act. To put that in comparison, the act before that only lasted 6 years. That was adopted in 88 and then replaced in 94. The School Finance Act of 94 was working pretty well. And then all of a sudden, Amendment 23 passed in the year 2000 that required not only that the base go up by inflation each year, but it would go up by inflation plus 1% for 10 years and then inflation thereafter. And that was an attempt to restore K-12 funding in Colorado back to levels in the early 80s when we had a more robust economy. What's interesting is when they created this inflation plus 1% with compounding, the state suddenly panicked that the voters had approved this and the state was worried how would they ever be able to afford it. And sure enough, when the economic recession hit in 08-09, if you remember, that was the financial sector near collapse. Also, the auto industry, the Bear Stearns and the other financial sectors that nearly collapsed, and some of them did. The state went through an economic recession. And of course, government lags the private sector. The regular recession was at 08, 09. It didn't hit the state budget until 09, 10. But the state had to have a way to reduce its budget because their revenues went down. Anytime there's a recession, people lose their jobs, so they pay less income tax, and or they spend less money, they get careful, and they quit buying large ticket items like cars and appliances and things that are generate a lot of sales tax income. So literally state revenue went down by nearly $1 billion, and the state didn't know how they were going to be able to fund K-12 with this constitutional amendment approved by the voters. And so they went to the Colorado Attorney General, interestingly, that he later became Colorado Springs Mayor, John Southers, and asked for opinion about could they change the school finance formula by adding a new factor. Originally, they called it the negative factor. Then later, they changed that to the BS factor. Why they would want to use BS over negative, I'll never quite understand. But they changed that to BS factor. And that was how they reduced funding so that we wouldn't bankrupt the state budget, which might have happened in that. If it wouldn't have bankrupted the state budget, it would have forced dramatic cuts in prisons and higher education and other state agencies that the state, it would have basically devastated the state budget. So that's why they created the BS factor. It reached its peak in about 10-11 at about a little over $1 billion. Then the state legislators started chipping away and bringing it down, and was getting down to about $500 million, $500 million. And then, of course, COVID hit. And then they immediately bumped it up to $1.1 billion as they were using state resources for COVID. And then they, since post-COVID, they've been rapidly bringing it down. Before, it was very slow. This time, they're actually talking about completely eliminating it for the 24-25 budget, which I think will probably happen because of the robust economy in Denver, and it will go away. But I just want to leave with one point. It'll be back. We need to know that the economic recessions come and go. And it's the only mechanism to adjust the state budget. So it may go away for 24-25, but it will be back in the future.
Yeah. So they basically, they still have that tool there if they need it, because they're not actually, they're paying down the deficit there, but they're not getting rid of it. So if they need to use it 2 years from now, it's, they don't have to pass a new bill necessarily. They already have that tool. Is that kind of a correct?
That's correct.
Excellent. So yeah, you had mentioned Denver briefly there. A story that a lot of us are aware of by now is the influx of migrants into Denver. And we're seeing more and more reports kind of on what's happening, how that's affecting their different services and things like that. And one of those services is the Denver public school system. And so I've seen different numbers. I think the number I've seen reported the most is probably around 3,200 students in Denver public school systems, and an influx of them in a very short amount of time. And now when we were talking about, funding and things like that, and kind of dollar amounts basically attached to students, when you think of 3,200 students, you're like, okay, well, that's 3,200 students that maybe they weren't budgeted for and hadn't planned on having, and now all of a sudden they do. So can you kind of give us an idea of maybe how that could affect a school or the school system or the district, anything along those lines as far as funding when you get a big influx of students?
Of course. And it's important to remember that under the current Colorado School Finance Act, we count kids on October 1. And there's actually a 15-day window, a week before and a week after count day, where if a student is in their seat, we get to count them for funding. And there's even a few other exceptions if they come after the count day, as long as they're not counted in another district. But this phenomenon that we're seeing with Denver Public Schools and Aurora and other more urban centers. I think even District 11 in Colorado Springs is getting some of them. So they're getting this influx of students way after count day. So these districts will not get any funding this year for those students. And yet they'll have to provide, could be teachers, you know, depending on how many are centered in one geographic region. It could be nurses, counselors, social workers, interpreters. Denver and Colorado Springs D11 have community liaisons that help with these issues. They help them with housing and shelter and food and clothing and all those things. And so obviously there's a financial impact to the district to serve these students. Now, next year, assuming those students are still here, and of course, we know that at least we think we understand that some of these students will not be here permanently. They may move on. I remember I heard a statistic that like 50% will stay and 50% will move on. But if they're here now and it's after count day, the district won't get any funding. And if they're gone by next October 1, they'll never have gotten funding for those students. And yet they will have had to incur costs to serve those students. Right now, my understanding is the state is discussing, can they help those districts with a supplemental appropriation to help provide funding for them after the fact? I don't think we have a bill yet to that effect, or if we do, it's still in draft form. So we'll see how much that is and if that really happens. But without a doubt, school districts are required to educate all students regardless of alien status or residency. So if those students show up in the schools, the districts have to educate those students. And they know that it's not only educate, because a student can't be ready to learn if they're worried about where their next meal comes from or if they have proper clothing on a cold day like today. So these districts are providing these resources to enable these children to have the best educational opportunity, and it's a real financial impact. So it'll be interesting to see if the legislature will help that, because if they don't, then it's kind of an unfunded mandate on the district to just absorb that cost into their budget. And while districts have reserves that can help with those things, not for this rapid of an impact. Right. They're not prepared for this kind of thing.
Yeah. And that'll be interesting, because then you're going from, if the legislature does have to do something supplemental, then, you know, that's, I guess you could say, coming from the state budget, as opposed to the Denver specific, money for school funding. So I'm sure that will be a very big fight, because you're going to have a lot of legislators from all around the state saying, okay, so now we are helping pay more out of our state budget to fund an issue that is mostly contained in Denver because of Denver's own policies. So, that's something we'll definitely keep an eye on. And I appreciate you, making that point. So, bringing it to our attention. So we've talked a lot about the school districts. How does charter school funding differ from traditional school districts?
Great question. So we've seen a pretty rapid explosion of charter schools in the last 20 years. Maybe explosion isn't the right word, but we've seen a fairly significant increase in charter schools over the last 20 years or so. I remember at District 11, we were one of the first districts to authorize charter schools after the legislation changed to allow those. So districts can be either chartered by the school district that they reside in, that we call that their charter authorizer, or if they mutually agree, they can be chartered by the state through the Charter School Institute. We call it CSI because we love acronyms. So they could either be authorized by CSI or the local district, but the local district has first primary control over the decision of whether or not to authorize them. Once they're authorized by either entity, then their funding, if they're in a local district, they get their fair share of the same PPR per pupil revenue of that local district. And so it flows down through the charter based on their enrollment. And in theory, they're supposed to get their fair share of all federal and state funding as well. Although we see some anomalies of that across the state, where some districts are a little bit more flexible and agreeable to that, and some are a little bit less flexible and agreeable to that. But that's how the districts get funding. Where it really gets tricky is if you're a declining enrollment district, like District 11, and you add charter school students, you not only the district is losing funding, but they're giving full funding to the charter, and it creates some interesting dynamics there that I've actually helped them try to model so they can plan appropriately for that. But when we think about charters versus district, and I think charters, you know, first of all, I'm sure charters are here to stay for a long, long time. And if anything, they will continue to grow. I've heard of other regions in the United States that were ahead of Colorado in terms of authorizing charter schools, that in especially in larger urban areas, they will come close to an equilibrium of about 50-50 traditional versus charter. In the end, the Colorado Department of Education and most districts would like to believe that all kids are their kids, whether they're charter or traditional, and every parent wants what's best for their child. And so sometimes charters have a magnet theme that better suits that parent. Maybe it's a specific program that better suits that program, or maybe it's just a fundamental philosophy about education and discipline and curriculum that a parent and a student prefer over a traditional district. It could be any of those factors. Where it's interesting, the differences between the two, that, you know, we should rest assured that charter students have to take the same assessments as traditional district students. Of course, parents can opt out, but the charters are required to offer that. And while they can waive out of certain state policies and regulations, generally speaking, there's not as many as people think. They generally are bound by the same rules as a traditional district in terms of education. The one big disadvantage for a charter is charters are not able to go on the ballot to get a bond issue. So when you think about a building, a school facility, it's the biggest investment a charter school has to make. And they can't go to the voters and say, hey, will you approve this tax increase to pay for this building? A charter has to pay for that out of their operating funds. Whereas a district, if they approve a bond issue, they get a tax increase to pay for it. They don't have to touch their operating funds. That's a huge advantage for a district and a pretty significant financial impact on the charter to come up with that building. Now, some districts are better about providing facilities. In District 11, we provided schools that we were closing to the charters, and we did that proactively to keep those neighborhoods alive. But not all districts can do that or want to do that. And so that's a big difference between the charter and the traditional district. And just to put that in perspective, we see charters paying 25 to 30% of their operating budget on a building, whereas a traditional school district is paying, you know, just repairs and maintenance, you know, a number, you know, less than 5% sometimes. Because they both have utilities and those things. So those are kind of a wash. Where charters have the advantage over over traditional districts is in terms of operating costs. So what we typically see is school districts have to have a large IT department. They usually have to have an assessments and testing department. They have to have a giant HR department to hire all those people. And traditionally, school districts tend to run in the neighborhood. If you don't count facilities and transportation, they tend to run in the neighborhood of about 10 to 15% administration costs. Whereas a charter, they can usually do it easier, more efficiently, and leaner. They can outsource for technology because they don't need a giant technology system. They don't need a giant HR department. They don't have to deal with as many rules and regulations as a big district. And so we typically see charters are much more efficient in terms of administrative costs and come nowhere near the district cost. So in one case, I wouldn't say those two level out because the building is a big deal. It's a big number. But it does bring a little bit of equilibrium back to the equation.
Excellent. Well, thank you for explaining all that. I understand that the legislature commissioned an interim school finance task force to make recommendations on the school finance system. Do you know how their recommendations are playing out right now?
Right. They just finished and issued their report within the last month. They are recommending some fairly significant changes to the school finance formula. As I mentioned before, the School Finance Act's 30 years old. It's getting fairly mature in terms of School Finance Act. I personally have sat on three different interim school finance committees without any significant changes, only minor tweaks. This one feels like it has legs, not only because they're having to address the rural school funding issue, which is still a problem in Colorado, but also because of the political environment at the Capitol. That generally speaking, and this is a broad generalization, so please don't overreact to this. What we're seeing is some proposals that would redistribute the formula towards higher poverty at-risk districts and away from higher socioeconomic, lower poverty school districts. So we don't like to really call them winners or losers, but the districts that are going to probably, if this were to be implemented, would receive more funding are the Denvers, the Auroras, even a little bit to Colorado District 11, Colorado Springs District 11, Pueblo. Those districts will get more funding under this equation because the at-risk component and the ELL component, English Language Learner component, is greater. The downside is the recommendation in order to fund that, because that costs more money, is the one of the recommendations is they reallocate the formula away from higher socioeconomic districts. So some of those districts like Douglas County, Academy District 20 in Colorado Springs, Lewis Palmer, Fort Collins, Aspen, they actually, while they may not lose funding, they won't get any increase. So it's a net loss for those districts, while these other districts will see a fairly significant increase in funding. So we don't know yet. There's no bill yet at this point in time on March 8th to know if this is really going to go forward. We do think there's a chance that this may move forward at least partially. And so everybody is watching this carefully to see how this will be implemented. There could be some discussions about delaying it for a year. There could be some discussions about phasing it in. And there could also be discussions about maybe we hold harmless those other districts, but still increase the higher poverty districts. So we'll see how all that plays out. But I think the important point to the whole question is, in 30 years, we haven't had any significant changes in the School Finance Act. This one feels like it could happen, and it's got some legislature push to make it happen. And so, I feel like it's got a shot that this could actually go through.
Interesting. Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. And we should probably know more, let's see, maybe in a month or so. Does that sound about
wait
right?
For the state's waiting for the quarterly economic forecast before they release the School Finance Act, which I'm sure they want to know that the March forecast, which comes out in late March, early April, for this bill as well. So my guess is about a month from now, we'll start to know.
Okay.
Things will move very fast, as you know. Things accelerate quickly at the legislature as we get close to the end. And we'll see all this start to come together.
Okay. So just for the listeners, because we don't necessarily release these things the very next day. We release about once a week. So we're recording this on March 8th. So about a month from now, let's say early April. So we'll keep an eye on that as it moves through. Glenn, I want to respect your time. So I just have like two more questions for you. And then we'll let you go, I promise. So this is kind of a pretty simple, straightforward question. Why is school finance so complicated? And isn't there a simpler way to fund schools in Colorado?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because the old formula, the 88 formula, was very simple. It created different regional zones and it funded those districts based on their zone. And they called them setting categories. And there were only, I think, 8 categories, if I remember right. You know, the current School Finance Act isn't necessarily super complicated. It is intended to provide resources to districts based on their unique needs in their region in Colorado. And so it makes sense to me from a common sense perspective that Aspen would get more funding than Aguilar because I happen to know that the lowest price house on the market in Aspen, Colorado is $5.7 million. And Aspen still has to hire bus drivers and food service workers and paraprofessionals. And they've got to live somewhere. You know, and right now, I'm pretty sure most of those people cannot even live anywhere between Aspen and Glenwood Springs, you know, so they're having to live down valley in order just to be able to afford to live. And so that makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. The smaller you are, the more money you get because of economies of scale. And we certainly know that the cost of educating students with educational challenges where they're not performing at grade level are greater. And sometimes money can help with that. Now, I think we've seen studies that have shown really money isn't always the answer. It's a low positive correlation in terms of student achievement, but it is a low, it's not a zero correlation. And so the current School Finance Act isn't necessarily bad, but it's mature and it needs to probably be modified. For example, rural schools are struggling with an exodus out of the rural areas where they can't attract and retain teachers, especially for math and science and special education and things like that. And right. I think it makes a lot of sense to put the rural school funding formula, which they've been doing a supplemental for that, to put it inside the formula. But long answer to shorten that a little bit is school finance is complicated because the world is complicated. I once had a school board member ask me the same question. And I said, you don't think Walmart every day is trying to figure out a way to shave pennies off of the cost of shaving cream? The world is complicated. Everybody's looking for ways to be more efficient. And I don't think the school finance formula is any different. And quite honestly, I think we should appreciate the fact that they're trying to make it more efficient. And that's a good thing. That's what the private sector does every day. And we would all like for government to be more efficient.
Absolutely. Last question for you, Glenn. What issues do you see facing Colorado schools in the near future? I know that's kind of a broad question and that it might be multifaceted, but just something that jumps out at you considering you work in this every single day.
Yep, you bet. You know, number one, I would say is safety and security. You know, we live in this bizarre world where suddenly it's okay for someone. It's not okay, but to shoot an elementary school child and murder them. So safety and security is of tremendous importance. Every parent wants their student to be safe at school. And so I remember when I started District 11, and that was 35 years ago, we had one security officer for the whole district, you know, and now they have to have this giant security department, you know, with a dispatch unit and vehicles and training and everything that goes with that. And I just see that getting bigger and bigger as the world becomes more challenging and with more violence. I see that getting bigger and bigger. In addition to that, I think we're seeing in Colorado, we're seeing a plateau and a decline in enrollment, which is going to create interesting variables for school funding and districts as they start to lose their enrollment, since enrollment drives most of their funding. I think the academic challenges of school districts continue to be prevalent. You know, we all know the studies that show that we're the last I heard, Colorado is the 7th most affluent state in the country. And yet we really don't have the best student achievement compared to that. And so student achievement is going to be a big deal as we try. Our whole economy in the United States depends on academic proficiency for young people that become adults. And so I think that'll be a big issue. The social needs that are arising as we have higher poverty and we're dealing, it's one thing to have to educate a child, but when we have to feed them and clothe them and comfort them and nurse them, that adds cost to it. And then I don't want to forget that we're about to leave this biggest influx of government grant funding in the form of ESSER. And a lot of districts now are challenged to figure out how to survive without that funding. The smart districts did that quickly, and they didn't use that funding to supplant their budget. And they used it to supplement their budget, but some districts didn't do that. And so we're going to see some districts struggle with that in the coming years, and that will be a challenge for them.
Can you clarify, Glenn, for the audience, you said ESSER. Can you just kind of clarify what you actually mean by that?
Yeah, ESSER is stimulus money that came from the federal government. It was actually the third, fourth, and fifth stimulus payments from the federal government as a result of COVID. I don't even remember what ESSER stands for. Elementary and Secondary Education Relief, I think, is what it stands
for.
That
sounds right.
But first there was ARRA, and eventually we had three rounds of ESSER.
Right.
For some districts, that money was huge. In my old district, District 11, we're talking well over $50 million over that three-year period. And so we're very concerned that districts that supplanted their budget, meaning used federal funds to pay for things that they used to pay for with general fund money, now have to bring those back into the general fund and afford it, as opposed to supplement it, which I know in District 11, they did a great job of this, of saying, hey, this is this extra money and we're going to use it for these things. And when the grant money is gone, we'll go away. And so supplant versus supplement, it's a big issue. And some districts did a better job of that than others.
Yeah, no, that's great to know. Like you said, it's stimulus money. It's temporary money. And so don't think that you can just, it's like getting a temporary job and then you run out and buy a house and get a new car and everything. And it's like, hey, this is only short term. Yeah. Those payments are going to keep going, after that money runs out. So, I hope
for
school
the district
districts
and the taxpayers.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Glenn, listen, this has been so informative. I feel like an expert now listening to you, and I hope the audience feels that way. I know I will probably go back and listen to this multiple times, especially when we start hearing more with what the legislature is going to do with school finance and everything. I know I'm going to come back here and get refreshed on it, and that's really what we wanted. We wanted someone who is listening as an audience member to have no idea about school financing, listen to this episode, and now they're like, you know what? I actually think I know how it works. And I think you did an excellent job explaining that. And so we really appreciate it. And, you know, maybe we'll have you come back on in the near future and talk about what actually did end up passing and funding and everything, and get an update from you on there. So we really appreciate it. If the audience, if you guys appreciate this, please, you know, do all the usual stuff, like, subscribe, share, give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple or YouTube or, you know, wherever you're listening to this at. But again, Glenn, thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure, Jarvis. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.